Mr. Edgar, reel two.
The tanks were loaded onto the flat cars. If I remember, it was four Cromwells and a couple of Centurions. And they also put a railway carriage on for our comfort. Although the bivvy, which is basically a tent which one fits either to the side or the back of the tent when one isn't fighting and at night sort of thing to keep a bit of the bad weather off, that did fit on the end of the tank and there was still space on the flat car to take it. Several of the guys slept in there and some in the railway carriage. We'd been told to look out as we were going north for the North Korean guerrillas who were left behind from the advancing Americans when they broke out of the Taegu box, which would be, I suppose, sort of August time, 1950. But we didn't see any. And one of us always had to ride shotgun up in the engine. He had a Sten gun for armament sort of thing. And you were sitting on a steel seat. And the two Koreans there, the driver and the fireman, couldn't speak English. And to keep you warm, they put shovelfuls of coal under the seat. Well, this is all right when it's cold, but it soon got blessed hot, you know, and you were sort of jumping about and saying, no, no, it's all right, no more, no more. But it didn't. All he would do was grin and put some more underneath there. We took it in turns to ride shotgun, which wasn't bad. You had to do it, so that was all there was about it. Mostly the train ran on slack. There was no knobs of coal, as one knows knobs of coal for firing a hand-fired fire. And it all seemed to go straight up the funnel and back down around you, and absolutely filthy one got with this soot sort of thing. You know, the slack, it didn't seem to burn very well. I mean, obviously it did, because you got the steam for the engine. The wheels seem to be square. I suppose the engine itself isn't sprung like a carriage or anything. And I can remember now, it seemed to be square wheels turning all the time on this journey. We would have all frequent stops at stations to take on water. One never realised how much water an engine used, but it was always, if ever you stopped, they had to take on water. And then you would go round and see if you could find some wood to put into the fire. They'd put a fire in the carriage and have the inevitable brew up. But wood was in short supply, so anything on the station that was made of wood and would come apart was taken apart. And it was just pure wanton destruction, really. And I don't know if there was any compensation paid. I doubt it very much. But we didn't worry. We were sort of getting hardened to the life.
Did you see anything of the Korean civilians and the state they were in?
Not really. You saw trains coming down from the north with, at first you could see, well, what's all this white? But it was literally refugees, and they hang on inside, outside, on the roof, a bit like you see in the films. I can't get what it was called now, but one Kenneth Moore did one in India. And they had all the natives quite literally hang on the outside. And they were like this, the Koreans. They smothered the engine. And, of course, most of their clothing was white. And you could just see this white train coming towards you. One would often get them coming and trying to sell us eggs. Well, it must have been on the boat, I suppose. But previously we'd been told not to have anything uncooked. You had to cook everything and boil the water because of the human excreta in the ground, fertilizer, you would get the disease, you see. And these Koreans used to come round with a half a dozen eggs in, one could sort of describe it as a tube made from straw, and the eggs would sort of nestle in there. Sometimes they would be cooked, sometimes they would be raw, but we never bought any. I mean, we had plenty of compo rations on the tank itself, so you had dried egg powder. A few came round, I think it was probably at Seoul, when we went through Seoul, selling a few souvenirs, bits and pieces. But one didn't really have much contact with them. There weren't a lot at the railway stations where we stopped to take on the water. basically at that time, no, we didn't see anything. Well, one saw them, but one didn't have, you know, contact with them. The journey took, I suppose, best part of a week. I said we were continually stopping, so in continually making a brew up. The train would often stop, and we would get out, put the kettle on, so to speak, and the train would go off, and then it would come back. Well, when we got to Pyongyang, it stopped. We got the inevitable brew up going, and it went off and came back. We didn't take a lot of notice, and then it went off again, and it didn't come back. We lost the damn thing, where it went to. And I suppose there was a sergeant and probably a couple of corporals and, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 blokes stranded there with nowhere to go, no tanks, no nothing. And we eventually, I suppose somebody must have gone off and found somebody or something. Anyway, we got back to the tanks later, and they were just being taken off with part of the regiment at Pyongyang. And then we went up into another Japanese barracks, which was better than the Pusan one, but there was no lighting and very little water. There was a terrible water shortage there. And I can remember when we got off of the train onto the tanks and then we're going north, the big bug out, as the Americans called it, had started. So they were all streaming back. If you can imagine bank holiday trip to the seaside with the cars bumper to bumper, this is how the Americans were, and they're going south. And they kept shouting, "You're going the wrong way, buddy, you're going the wrong way." And we said, "Oh yeah, well, we're British, we're all right, don't worry about it," sort of thing. We arrived at this Jap barracks. I think it was just getting dark when we got off the train, so it could have been quite a few hours later. Being that middle of November, it was getting dark early then. I guess about 9 o'clock in the evening or something like that, and torches were about, because as I say, there's no electricity. And we must have had something to eat there, because the regiment or a squadron of us were there, as well as recce troop. And we got fed, and the next day we had to do an oil change on the tank. And they'd got no gallon cans, all they'd got were pint cans. Well, why have we got to change this oil? Well, when you want more oil, it'll be American, and it won't mix with the British stuff you've got there, so that's why you've got to change it. So we drained off, and there seemed to be hundreds and hundreds of these little pint cans of oil that we had to put into the tank engine. Don't know how many gallons it took, but I mean, quite a few, I would imagine. And then they sent some ammunition, and it was the wrong sized ammunition. It was American, so that all had to go back. One would say, perhaps typical army, you know, lack of communication between them. I suppose we were there probably a couple of days, and then we sort of took on the orderly withdrawal.
Did it surprise you to see the Americans retreating, or had you expected that something like that might happen?
Didn't give it a lot of thought, really. I mean, we didn't know much about the American army at that time. Afterwards, after we were taken prisoner, which was only to be about, well, I guess a month's time. That must have been towards the end of November, early December, when we were at Pyongyang. We discussed it and said they were all right, the Americans, if you wanted a road or a bridge building or supplies coming up. But once it got down to the nitty-gritty of fighting, which is what a soldier is supposed to do, they were no good at all. So with hindsight, one isn't surprised that they were going bugging out, sort of thing. And one can read books on Korea from American authors, and many of them will tell you that the officers were there and telling the guys, either get up out of the ditch or I'll shoot you. And presumably it was the truth. Again, with hindsight, yeah, you can understand they were bugging out, sort of thing, or going away from the fighting.
Did there seem to be ill-disciplined troops then?
Not so much as ill-disciplined, but let's get away from the sharp end. No, I don't know that they are ill-disciplined, or quite what it is, or whether it's the commanders, the generals, etc., etc., who sort of say, well, you've got to come out.
What was the weather like at this time? Was it snowing?
I don't think it was then. It wasn't till about the middle of December, if I recall, we had our first snowfall that we'd experienced. But yes, it was cold. It must have been pretty freezing. The Korean winters are much, much harder than an English winter, and we experienced three of them, two in captivity, and that sort of, the winter of 50-51, well, the first half, the 50 half, we were still free men then, I suppose. But yeah, it was getting cold. One had got one's tank suit, which was a godsend because it was all zipped up and you could keep relatively warm. And at that time, one could light a fire and keep warm, because we weren't in the firing line at all, so you were basically able to do, within reason, light fires to keep yourself warm. But yes, it must have been getting much colder. I suppose, it took about a week. We went south, it was about mid-December. They decided not to use the Centurions, and we'd heard, purely a rumour, that the Americans had complained that they were too heavy for the Korean roads. Well, one could understand this, but I don't think there were any tarmac roads except the main supply route, the MSR, which ran basically north to south and went through the main towns. All the byroads were just sort of what one would perhaps describe as dirt tracks. And I suppose they said, no, you can't use the Centurions, they're too heavy. We sort of went back, and I think this was the one or two occasions when some of the Cromwells had problems. But out of the six, I don't think it was many. We hadn't got an officer at the time. I don't know what had happened to him, but he went off. Rogers, I'm pretty sure his name was, and he was relieved. We didn't think a lot of him, really. We had a chap come by the name of Probin, and he was much better. But that wasn't until probably towards the end of December, and he didn't stay with us long. I think he was a lieutenant. He actually died in a prisoner of war camp, but he wasn't taken when we were taken prisoner. I don't know how or when he was taken prisoner. But he went off, and then just before the new year, we had a lieutenant, not Ashley Cooper, Alexander, who was nephew of Field Marshal Alexander of Tunis. And they then formed a composite squadron of six Cromwells from the 8th Hussars and six Royal Artillery Observation Post Cromwells. It was known as Cooper Force, under Captain Ashley Cooper, who was a regular officer with the 8th Hussars. And although we had a major from the artillery, Captain Ashley Cooper was in charge. I think it's something to do with a cavalry regiment being the armoured regiment as opposed to the artillery, something like that, anyway. We joined the regiment. I remember getting some notepaper and that sort of thing, and also had a parcel come from my mother with a cake in it, which went down quite well. Anything like that, it was always shared round with the rest of the crew, any goodies that came from home. Compo packs, there were a five-man compo pack which was allocated to each tank, and without having a commander, they took him away and we hadn't got one the best part of coming back from Pyongyang. And we thought that was quite good, because you've got this extra ration, you see, for four bods instead of five. And that age, 19, one's perpetually hungry. But we did do a bit of swapping between the Americans. They used to have I suppose about a 4-pound tin of corned beef hash, which was quite good as opposed to the bully beef and what one was used to. You know, it made a nice change to one's diet. That went down quite well. We didn't stay long with the regiment. So they made up this new composite squadron, called it Cooper Force, and then we had to move up to support the Ulster Rifles, and we were at a chicken farm, and that was just before Christmas. I don't think there were any chickens there.
Do you know where this was?
It was just north of Saul, but exactly where, no, I don't know. And that's when we had our first snowfall, and we had to dig slit trenches there, but never did find out why. We had our Christmas dinner here. It was in a big barn of a place, and several of the regiment were there who weren't armoured, because Leggett was on the ammunition truck and not drinking much beer. I gave him mine. I'd known him in Civvy Street, and we ended up in the same regiment. Our paths had crossed several times, finally with him driving the ammunition truck for Cooper Force. It must have been getting much colder here, because we were issued with two Kapok-filled sleeping bags, and they went down very well. Bedding consisted of two sleeping bags, one waterproof one. It was sort of waterproof on the bottom with a cotton top to allow the condensation to come through, otherwise you were sort of full of water all the time. And we had four blankets as well, and the tank suit. Well, that was all okay, and you think, well, what do you do with this when you're in action? Well, it was all rolled up and tied up basically with a piece of string and put on the back of the tank, which was all very well until you got, what shall I say, hit by a phosphorus bomb or an incendiary bullet, and the lot started to burn, which must have happened to several of the tanks, because they, you know, you could see bedding that had been burnt during the battle, if you follow me. When we were in action, tanks would go by and you could see bedding sort of smouldering or burning on the back in the dark, so it made a good bonfire.
So did the putting of bedding on the back of the tank endanger the tank?
Well, I suppose it must have done, really. But you see, again, we were in a valley in action, and at night they left the tanks there. Well, now, the reservists said this is something that never, ever happened during the Second World War. We were only, well, I say we youngsters, were only 19. We didn't know what one was supposed to do. We only followed orders. And again, it came down that the Americans said, you mustn't take out the tanks at night because it will be bad morale for the infantry. Well, bad morale, yeah, for the American infantry, but the British infantry would have accepted it, I'm sure, because they were used to fighting that way. And the reservists said, you do not leave tanks in a situation like that in the front line overnight, because they're sitting ducks. You can't see, you can't do a damn thing. That was probably the cause of the problem. We joined the 1st Royal Ulster Rifles a few miles below the front line. Would have been about the end of December, 28th, 30th, something like that, and we were on full alert, which meant somebody got to, well, we had guards always. We had to have two, I think it was, then. And Mr. Alexander, who joined us then, the Field Marshal's nephew, he said, right, I'll do the first one. You sort out between you other four when you're doing yours. Well, this was something the other tentat, the first one we'd had, Rogers, he would never have volunteered like that. I can recall when we got to the tanks at the race course at Poussin, he wanted a batman. I mean, he was only one or a two pipper. Well, I mean, those guys, they didn't have a batman each in England when you were with the regiment. I mean, a captain perhaps would have had a batman, and majors, but I mean, lieutenants, they probably shared. And this guy, Rogers, he wanted this batman. It never materialised, anyway. It was a place called Compo Valley with the Ulster Rifles. As I say, we were on full alert, so we were expecting to go up into the front line. And on the 1st of January, we set off. We had to hold the line in as much that the rest of the UN forces were withdrawing south of the Han River at Saul. And I remember Mr. Alexander saying ours would be the last tank over, because in the 8th Hussars, we had the 6 Cromwells, and we had Captain Astley Cooper, Lieutenant Alexander, they were the two officers, and then we had Sergeant Jim Taylor, who was an AA man in Silly Street, and a Sergeant Collins. They were both reservists. And we had Corporal Geordie Hogg and a Corporal Albert Spur. Albert was another reservist. Geordie Hogg was a regular. And Mr. Alexander said, "We'll be the last one over before the sappers blow the bridge." And I don't know when he could have told us it, but I've got letters now that I wrote to my parents almost up to the time, well, I would say perhaps the day before we were taken prisoner. And I remember telling them to keep their eye on the TV newsreels, because ours would be the last tank over, and they may see us, you see. I mean, this was 1950-51, and there weren't many television sets about. And father, being self-employed with his business at Dunsfold, he got one, but it wasn't to materialise. We weren't to go. However, on the 1st of January, we set off to hold the line with the Royal Ulster Rifles and the Northumberland Fusiliers. And it wasn't far, through a cutting in the hills and down into a valley and over a small river, and we took up a line below more hills. And then I suppose we were at the sharp end. One hears and reads so much about this part of soldiering, and there I was, there, 19 years old. But we'd come 9,000 miles, I think it was, something like that, to put out this fire, as the MP had said. But, refugees were coming down through the hills, and we'd been told to watch out for infiltrating North Koreans dressed as civilians. And I can remember one tank driver, he got hold of this Korean who could have been a soldier, obviously, but he didn't look like a soldier, and he was pulling him about and shoving him and giving him a kick here and there sort of thing. We said, "You want to watch it, mate? Could be your turn next." Anyway, the Korean went off and nothing materialised much. We didn't find any North Koreans, but whether they were there or not, one never knows.
Did he seriously injure him?
No, not at all. No, I don't think he sort of pushed him and shoved him around a bit and perhaps kicked him out the backside with his boot, but nothing really physical as such. No, he wasn't injured at all, I'm sure. They were only coming through in dribs and drabs as opposed to lots then. Sort of, you might have, the most perhaps would be perhaps a family with a grandmother and the grandfather and the mama-son. Papa's on the father, he was not much about, so to speak, and perhaps two or three children clutching their belongings on the back and sort of wandering through, but only in small, very small groups, no big long columns, and very spread out as well. It must have been on the, probably about the 2nd of January, we were shelling the hills with the 17-pounder. And they'd said the Chinese were up there, but one could look and not really see anything. It was sort of shrubby hillsides. They called up an airstrike, and it was Super Sabres, I think they called them, Royal Australian Air Force. And one could almost put one's hand out and touch them. I mean, you couldn't in reality, but they were very, very close, these planes, and they were putting down rockets and machine gun fire on the hills, which I suppose were probably only half a mile away, but if you're there, it seems very, very close, very close. This went on best part of the morning, I suppose. Not the strike, but shelling the, not the airstrike, but shelling the hills where the Chinese were reportedly have been. And I think we had one or two reports of the battle patrol out of the Royal Ulster Rifles having met some opposition. And I think, in fact, some of them, perhaps one or two or three, something like that, were killed or wounded on that 2nd of January morning. In the afternoon, things died down, and we just stood about, had something to eat, I guess, and talking and all the rest of it. And we must have slept there that night, obviously, because the real action didn't start until the following night. And on the 3rd of January morning, it dawned very bright and clear, peaceful sort of thing. They call it the land of the morning calm. If one experiences it, one can see where the name comes from. It is very, very beautiful. Almost idyllic, I suppose, really, this land of the morning calm, except perhaps the smell. They were, well, the Chinese, that is, were active. That was messages that were coming through. Nothing much happened that day, I don't think, not during the morning. I can't really recall whether we did fire on the hills on the 3rd of January or not. The Battle of Happy Valley, what would life be without comedians? Why they called it Happy Valley, I don't know. It may be for some, but not for others. Well, we were ready to retreat south of the river, and nothing happened until, I suppose, about 6 o'clock in the evening. It got dark, I suppose, around about 4. And at 6, they said, well, all right, they're going to pull out. And the infantry companies of the Royal Ulster Rifles and B vehicles, that's the trucks of Cooper Force, started leaving. And the tanks were stuck there. And this is when all the blokes, you know, the reservists, were saying that it shouldn't be. The Americans said it would be bad morale for the infantry. Well, maybe so. The Americans had been on the left flank, and this, again, is where one gets back to the Americans not being much of a fighting force, but all right, building bridges and roads, etc., etc. They'd gone, but whether or who knew anything of them or when they went, we didn't know. So time ticks on, and the stuff's going pretty slowly out, and it was about 9 o'clock, and the Chinese started firing then. And I remember looking at the watch and thinking, crikey, 9 o'clock, that's 1 o'clock back home. And it was a Wednesday, so it would be my mother and father's half day. Their shop at Dunsfold, they'd be shutting up shop. And I suppose one's mind goes back to one's loved ones, and you think, well, what are they doing? They don't know what I'm doing, but I know what they'll be doing. And within half an hour, we'd started to move. I was delegated as a runner for Mr. Ashley Cooper's tank, and his co-driver, a chap by the name of Titch Alford, a reservist, he was the runner for Mr. Alexander. And any messages we had to take backwards and forwards. Well, when it started and the tank started moving off, or when our turn came to move off, Ashley Cooper, Captain Ashley Cooper, I said, well, you go back to Mr. Alexander, Erica, so off I trot. It wasn't far, it was a few hundred yards, I suppose. And when I got there, Titch Alford had got in my co-driver's seat, and we were about to move. So Mr. Alexander said, all right, Erica, get on the back of the tank. Well, there wasn't much room on the back. You've got the bedding rolls, although they were sort of bundled up reasonably neatly. And the Chinese fire was coming from the sort of, I suppose it was the north and the rear. So I thought, well, there's not much